I'm on the 2008 committee. I hope to see you then. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for staying for the final session of Agile, and of course you stay with us for last. Thank you for attending. And as always, please turn your cell phone so that it is heard on either off or mute. You're the leader and you are here for the Literature and Humor Master Team presentation. If you don't already know our team guest, Michael Stackpole is a New York Times bestselling author of numerous science fiction and fantasy books, including titles in the Star Wars X-Wing Rogue Squadron series, Squadron for Conan, Carter Nancy, Masters of War, and The New World. He is also a successful video game designer and the author of Video Game Strategy Guide. Mike Stackpole's blog and podcast guest, get your pens out, www.stormwolf.com www.stormwolf.com. And I'm going to have a thank you very much. And now, my feedback call.
Well, first of all, for the meteor, library is one of the big parts of when I was growing up, it's reading the final school book gets fired everything out. And I remember the library very, very fondly from Rome for one, even though the library there was slowly sinking software. And every time I go back I keep wanting to see if it's gotten any lower or something. It is still let's just lay the library. The positive that would suggest the literature of the game is not just for teens. What I suggest is something that I definitely want to talk about because I've done novels, I've done games, I certainly see why they're interesting. But the sense that the topic comes with a value judgment loaded in there, that somehow game literature and by extension perhaps science fiction is juvenile. Is only meant for teens and was never meant for adults. And this is absolutely not true. One of the things, and I think all of you know this, things like science fiction and fantasy are not real genres. They are marketing categories. You know, this is really the work of Kurt Vonnegut, which is science fiction, and it's got its literature. You look at the work of Philip K. Dick, who, until a bunch of movies are made, of his work, was considered to be nothing more than a hack science fiction writer, and now he's considered an American master. If you look at magical realism, if you are Hispanic and you are writing, and it's translated into English, and you see those, this is literature, it is magical realism. If you are an Anglo, you write in English, you are writing horror when your character sees ghosts. If you throw magic in, you're writing fantasy. And one of the movies follows study, and the other is not. Now, I can tell by some of the thoughts of it, and in many ways I'm teaching you converse here, but part of the reason that this point is out is that any attempt you make to bring this sort of literature in and animal, push it as something for adults, not just for kids, not just for teens, it's going to run into this sort of resistance. You know, there is, unfortunately, out there, and I mentioned that there are library boards, I mentioned the library patrons, there are the Brahmins who decide that if something is popular, it must therefore be common, and therefore must not be worthy of support in something like a library. And yet, as librarians, certainly in an office, my concern is does this get people reading? Will it get them coming back? I regularly get emails, get told at conventions by people, you know, they'll ask, what are you doing with sequel to this book? I've read the previous one 7 times now. Now, you as a librarian, you're used to seeing books meant to destruction. Okay? By, you know, 13 or 14 different people taking this book out and it comes back and says, I'm talking about one guy. You know, one guy in his phone reading it to the point where it falls apart.
for
something. I must say, not that I have to love these people. Who knows?
So let's ban to buy multiple copies of
this. Giving it away.
Okay?
So this is the sort of literature base that you're going to be looking at.
I'll also say this. Pound for pound,
science fiction writers are the best writers in America.
The reason I say that is simply this.
Every other writer, be it literary, be it writing science fiction, are writing in a world that they already share with the readers.
If I'm writing a crime novel and I say, I walk into Starbucks,
everyone instantly knows that it's going to be one of the four Starbucks locations. You know, and with a couple of words placed in certain things in certain places, you know exactly which model it was. Alright? I know I can tell you your name, she's a sportscaster, she plays the Cardinals and has one thing in Texas. And when we were talking at Starbucks, and one time I called her myself because he was late, and we were both in the Starbucks, we were both sitting in the exact same position, he was settled all the way to me.
same thing, okay?
And so the white people writing the desperate fiction is that a shared world. Whereas science fiction and fantasy writers have got to create that world. Now this is one of the reasons why John Steinbeck is maintaining science fiction will never be considered literary. Because we spend probably 25% of the words that we put into a book describing the world, setting up the rules, setting things up so that you, as a reader, can figure out how things work. Now, in crime fiction, they do that too. But what they're doing in there is characters and motives and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, we're much tougher. I mean, we go ahead of the magic system, we go ahead of physics. I mean, you're going to know how all of this equipment works. So that just as you do in any other fiction, you figure the puzzle out the same time that we do. And this is something I always maintain. Writers and readers are engaged in the latter game of getting that too. The reader's job is to be on page 56 and say, I know how this book ends. And the writer's job will say, no, you don't. And if when they get to the last page, and they say, hey, I know how we got here, it wasn't where I expected to be, I think they come back. Alright? If, on the other hand, they get to the last page, and they don't write, they never come back. Because I failed their game. Yes.
Well, you were saying that, I think that someone I was talking to the other day, was that when they read a book, they make a story in their own, they create it in their own head. So is that, I always think of a writer writing a story, and he has a story to tell.
Right.
I want you to get something from it. So is that correct in both senses?
Well, it's correct in both senses in this way. And there's a bunch of literary theory that will talk about the collaboration between readers and writers. The fact is, if I'm describing a field in science, field is the sort of rule of the soft blue, you're going to have one color in mind. Everybody else in the room is having a different color in mind. Now, I know it's not, I just use a trick, because soft is not a color. Soft is not an adjective that usually goes with a color. But by using that, I'm forcing you to think. That means I've engaged your brain. That means I want you that much further into the story. You are now creating that world with me. Now, how it looks to you is going to be different from how it looks to everybody else. But in general, there will be some commonality. You'll be able to discuss that book with friends, and you won't know what you're talking about. You will each judge your vision and compromise the other person's vision. But you will have that commonality. The important thing as a writer, as all writers, the story we want to tell, we make sure that the rules are ironclad, make sure the stuff you have to know is there, and there's no mistake, it's nailed for you. So there's no arbitrariness on our part in that sense. You have no choice but to believe what we just told you. But everything else, we allow your imagination to run. And that really gets to the point for this talk. Why is any literature, why is science fiction, why is franchise literature, and by franchise literature I mean books written in media universes like Star Wars and Star Trek, or Buffy the Vampire Slayer and those things, why are these books so compelling? Why do they keep bringing people back?
I'll focus on Canyon, because I know it very, very well. And we'll go forward from there. Some of you will have or stock some of the role-playing manuals, the different games. Some of our systems aren't allowed to have them in there, aren't allowed to have dice or other things. These games all indicated that in 1974 when the EU was first published, it grew out of Lord of the Rings. Obviously with elves and dwarves and let me get called hobbits because the Tolkien stayed responsible on that, so they call them happily. That the whole Tolkien at Lord of the Rings provides the background. But you also have works of an author like Chris Blythe, Backwards of Mountains, who are wonderful fantasy novels, and there's five books in the collection of short stories and funny novels. Wonderful stuff. It's the works of Nigel Moorcock, the works of Ryan Blasney, the works of Jack Mann. All of these guys contributed stuff that went into the construction of fantasy worlds. You all had to give the really good role-playing game, like the second role-playing game that ever came out, well, that part of the Cup of Thrones, by Malcolm and M.E.R. Barker. M.E.R. Barker is a doctorate in comparative religion and he converted to Islam, and he created this incredible world that was unlike, it was not a Western world at all, it was very much Southeast Asian, along with a lot of Arabian subtopics in, and very modern influence. Has an incredible role. And the author Raven Spice, who worked with two other people to create a fantasy world called Dictinia, a real publishing product in the early 80s. And one day, Ray Spice was going in Dictinia. He was born, so he took the private title throne and basically had people that world invade Dictinia. And from there, he wrote his bestseller Rick Warren book. So pretty quickly, by the starting of 74, pretty quickly we had games that were more like novels, and then novels started being more back out of the game. And the middle ages of Dragonhead novels by Margaret White and Timothy Hickman, the New York Times bestseller list, from there was no looking back. By the end of the 80s, within the gaming industry, the professional gaming industry, It was just known. You could not launch a new role-playing game without a novel. Why was that? This is because role-playing games are a bunch of rules. You're rolling dice, you're doing that. That's pretty much all it is. When you break it down, that is all it is. But these novels invite people into the world. They give them a window onto the world and a sense of that world that you don't get from rolling dice. I remember doing a set of novels for a high tech role playing game, and that's a novel personally anyway here in Phoenix. And somebody came up to me and said, the game's in black and white, your novel is in color. And that is just how important those things were. Let's see. What is it about these games? The other thing about games that you also need to know is that one of the role playing games, you suddenly have computer games. Every one of the early computer role-playing games, and those computers will still maintain the computer games, not role-playing games, because you don't play a role, you play over a character, they get you and you run around and do things, but all of those are born straight out of the paper of the games. I mean, to this point where games systems are listed and someone probably should have listed it. There were some licensing things that did go on, but it is, again, an experiment, and what games allow you to do, the computer games do for a lot of people. There's certainly more people who have computer games than playing the paper pencil role-playing games. Is that now you are part of that adventure. You are going into that world. You can make differences. You are there. And so this is a big thing. Both the book and the game are very immediate experience and an immersive experience. If you're playing some of these games, you put headphones on, you hear other people talking, so the network game. Network games like World of Warcraft, and I'm sure you've all got blocks on your computers. So I already use it a lot of people going to website. Second Life is a game without a game, which I've been playing on this fascinating, running around and seeing how that all works. In Korea and other places, they even have role-playing games on cell phones. So that, you know, people when they're commuting can be connected out of the view and multiple stuff, get pulled into that other game. It's just amazing. This is just a way of where things are coming. And it is a very simple chance for you to slip away from the humdrum and enjoy yourself. We all know that books are that sort of a learned experience. And for gamers, the books then become the console. They've been enjoying the adventures, they've been living the adventures, and now all of a sudden, they're able to get into the book and follow characters, going places that they've never done in the game, doing things that they've never quite been able to do in the game. So it's another take on that whole experience. I'll tell you, the reason, especially for the novels, people will tell you there are different reasons why they read the novels. The reason, the primary reason they will tell you that they read these books to destruction is for the exploration. They get inside the world. They get to see things that they are constructing the way it looks. Computer graphics still have not quite caught up to what you can do with the brain. So a couple of really nice scripted passages and people are creating this whole world. Computers are really bad at learning technology and things. But an author in both sense is there. Computers are really bad in terms of tactile business. E. Cole, Dawson, Harvard, and you just don't get those. But again, in a novel, you get that. So the novel becomes that full sensory experience. You do get to explore, you get to learn about the world. The other thing which is really nice about books as opposed to games is that books are unchanging. You can always go back 4 or 5 chapters in the book and double check something. You really stop doing it again. You're also in a book, you're inside the head of a character. It's not always true in the game. You're not always there. One of the games that I enjoy a first person shooter is called a Call of Duty. It's a World War II game. So you're fighting Nazis, which they're a bad thing. You should not in this book. But there is no character there. I mean, you don't care. You just know you're shooting Nazis. But you know, it doesn't matter if the guy every time he came home. You know that bad friend who died. Nothing on that one. Whereas in the novel, all of those things are there. The other thing for the novel, as well as you all know, is your mental suspension of disbelief opens you up to all sorts of attachments, including emotional attachments. Once you decide to believe, once you invest enough in these characters, to know that these characters are real, you're stuck with them. Their eyes become your eyes, their love becomes your love. You've got a character that you like, you've got a character that you form a bond with, and all of a sudden that character dies, you feel a lot of pain. I won't say I enjoy clicking that pain, but I in fact know that it has to be done. You just get character reaction. I read a lot of military friends thinking, and it would be nothing but a giant explosion unless you have attached to characters, hope that they survive, felt tense when you weren't sure, and felt pain when you get stuck. That's just the way it is, and it's part of that whole experience that he's bringing you back. So, here's the weird thing. Here's the real reason why people need these novels, why they keep going back to them over and over and over again. Like, I read a lot of military science fiction. I go to conventions, I have guys, you know, Navy SEALs, guys who are Rangers, I mean, guys who are like, still people from early, like my brother does, because he's in the Army. It's a tough guy. This guy has a military ego. I'm writing military science fiction, but I'm not. But they're looking at it, I'll expect the question that they will have is they'll want to know about, did I make this battle on such a historical battle, or they want to talk about the tactics, or those things? No, they want to talk about the terrorists. It's also about the part of their in the battle tank novels, which is a big giant robot running around shooting each other in all their novels, there were two characters, Romeo and Juliet. Son of one house, or one government, the daughter of another one, they meet, they fall in love, they fall apart. And Ratchet and Ness for years will they ever get together? That's what you guys care about. They care about the characters. They build up that bond. They enjoy meeting those characters, being tortured. They enjoy seeing the characters in their lives, they enjoy seeing their up and down. They want to see that next installment. They want to know what's going to be happening next. And that's the stuff they absolutely keep coming back for. You also have the right to be. The advantage that we have over Danny is that, and the advantage that we have over people just starting out to write their own characters, is that if you've been around for a while, you tend to create far more complex characters that you're never going to have in the game. Any character is determined by what goes on in the event. Well, computer game world and Call of Duty, there is no character there. I mean, I can decide that my character's a mess thing, and you will have absolutely nothing to do with what's going on in that game. I mean, that's just the way it goes. So there's no character, you don't need a character. Or some of the other games where they will project a character out for you, but again, you don't know that character's background, and what you know of his background, if there is anything there, so it's for you to do. They don't affect the game plan. But the characters that you created that interface with the world tell you more about the world. They allow you to handicap what's going on, and again, you've got that total emotional attachment to those characters. And so if you just really get caught up in that. And then you'll notice, when I'm talking about what people need for, when I'm talking about characters and stuff like that, I can be talking about literary. I can be up there lecturing you on what makes it literature. And it's characters. It's sharing the world. It's telling the story. And that's what that leads you to be. And that is what drives people to keep coming back to these things over and over and over again. It was kind of interesting, statistically, after 9/11, immediately after 9/11, book publishing was in a total tizzy because readership dropped off, sales dropped off, book readership dropped off, sales dropped off, and they dropped off in every section of the market. They have the management of business. Management of business is the only section of the market that helps today. Now, one could say that it's total schedule, but heck, you know, what's going on in 9/11, why not? You know, that's not too big. Another reason that people read is, again, as opposed to the game, the action comes to your feet so often in these games. So much is happening, you have no chance of tracking what's going on. When I was doing the Star Wars novels, but they were making up a license for the X-Wing TIE Fighter computer game. And so I was working through the TIE Fighter game. Remember, one of the scenarios is very simple. Flying in, while your ship is 50 meters of another ship, so you can scan it and survive for 13 minutes. And that 13 minutes, I burned out a joystick trying to survive for 13 minutes. I had no idea what I was doing other than walking in front of me, watching the scope behind me, and dodging a lot. I mean, that was it. You know, and playing. And I survived, so that was good. But no, there's no thing. Now, in the novel, you get to appreciate the action. You get to watch what's going on, and that's cool. You get to revisit those things, which is fun by scenes and that sort of stuff. This is, by the way, a curious thing when you talk about these books not being for teens anymore. These books tend to be written on two levels, or at least read on two levels. When the X-Wing books is for education specialists, I get a lot of letters from sixth graders, boys who are 12 years old. X-Wing Rogue Squadron, the first of the X-Wing books that I did, will be the first book that they ever read all by themselves. And they're fairly proud of that fact. It is kind of cool. They're sixth graders. The book actually tests out an eighth grade reading level. But because they know Star Wars so well, they've got an installed vocabulary, so they're able to actually be reading at something higher than their level. But what the sixth graders love is all the action. They love the things that blow off. They think that's cool. All the characters stuff they want to know, yeah, they can do that. Readers who are not sixth graders, adult readers, kind of wish with all those action chapters that they put a box score at the end of it, who lives, who dies, whether they kill them. You know, because they don't want to read these 13 minutes of running around afraid to die, so they do not die. But they get into all the character stuff, and they very much get into it. This is one of the things that I write about. You know, I knew without that, the general stuff of Star Wars, and I've seen it because the aspect of Star Wars literally traveled all over the world. Star Wars and the books have got fans that go anywhere from 12 years old to you know, great grandparents who are reading them for themselves or reading for kids. And this is, I mean, Star Wars especially, it's so iconic. You know, with the exception of a few people, that I'm included, you know, almost everybody has seen at least one of the movies. And certainly everybody understands them. I mean, the fact that we joke about it, Jane being Darth Vader, just gives you the indicative of how pervasive that mythology and its mythology has become. And again, you know, these things are very, very attractive. People recognize Star Wars. When I do book signing, very curious. If I do a book signing at a store and I am billed as a Star Wars writer, there will be 2 to 3 times as many people will show up because I'm just looking at the science fiction writer. Now, it's just Star Wars that makes me all that different. And Star Wars is one of those things which is very, very attractive to readers. Another thing which books bring that you don't get out of the game is that books you can have suspense. One of the things about the game is that when you get into a difficult situation, you say, you go through that difficult situation, you die, you go back to where you say, and you go again. And you keep going. Well, I feel it's more than a good moment, unless you drink too much. There is no suspense. You know exactly what's going to happen, and you're just trying not to allow that to happen again. Which is not always easy, but, you know, you just try to mess things. And so then, fault-falling is certainly fun, but there is no suspense. And so the books offer you that part of the experience that you can't get otherwise. You go into one of these games, again, first-person shooter, you know you will die. You're reading one of these books, you're hoping the characters will die. And so that is a big difference. And that certainly engages the readers very, very tightly. So, with these books, and it strikes me that, as a librarian, one of the things you're probably concerned with is getting people in and getting them reading, getting them coming back, serving the community. And I think that these novels can do that. They can do that because they are things that readers come back to over and over again. They are things that are relatively easy to get into, provided your readers get over a bias that it's really great. It doesn't happen in science fiction, funny enough. It doesn't happen very much in fantasy. One of the things that I hear over and over again, people will say, I'm not smart enough to read science fiction. Well, that wasn't the writer's not part of the writer. So this is not, intelligence is not the key. It's good science fiction. From good science fiction, it'll explain everything. You will be educated in time, you will understand what's going on. And then so that should not be a problem. But these are books that attract people. And once you get somebody in reading science fiction, and I had a librarian, visiting yesterday, during the reception. She came over and asked me, do you remember your Godlike books? And I was like, oh, yeah. That's 14 of them. I made a chance to sit there. Her son was not a reader. He was not interested in reading, and then he found those books. And boom, he just walked in. Those are the books that got him to be a reader. So, you know, science fiction is very, very attractive that way. And science fiction is also, because the general term of science fiction has got successful people who like doing math, like apartment. They've got all the Star Wars books. They've got tons and tons of fantasy books. You know, books that are tough reading, like Lord of the Rings and writing Stephen Harrison, another one Scott Baker. Brilliant writers, but he's also another one. Really, really good writers. You haven't heard of the department of the books, but great ones. What you're in, you know, wonderful. And then there's also, you know, there's a lot of just stuff that's a lot lighter, this stuff is a lot easier to read. There was a lot of science fiction that gets dressed up as juveniles. And, you know, obvious case in point, the Harry Potter. Harry Potter was something interesting. You know, everybody who locked in, everybody who's read a Harry Potter book, has had that portal open to science fiction fantasy. They will be excited about it. So these are things that I think these books are books that should be stocked. I think these are books that are going to see a lot of circulation, and I think they're books that will attract people. And I know a lot of science fiction readers, a lot of science fiction writers, who got their start reading science fiction in libraries, from libraries. You know, it's pretty bad for a lot of parents. You know, this, the parents don't read science fiction. This is not legitimate. But if you can get out of the library, it must be okay. And you know, all we know, their parents are bad, the way that that works. You know, they don't know what their kid does, as long as you put them in the library, that's okay. I also think, I just have to say this, that I think that, that there are some opportunities beyond just circulation, just getting patients to take out books, that science fiction is going to be popular. Libraries have always seemed to be at the center of the community. And having a science fiction reading group, a science fiction writing group, are absolutely fine. There is nothing, science fiction people have contentment. They voluntarily get together, question themselves, and others out, pay a bunch of money to do nothing but chat about science fiction. Do you want that once a month? They would not love to go to a library and talk about books they all have to read. They don't support it. And you go to these events, you scratch literally half the people that in any science fiction book discussion want to be writers. And they will tell you they could have done a textbook better. And here's where it's true. I will say this. Not every work in science fiction and fantasy is brilliant. There are books where the writers just pulled it in. There are books where there are writers who are working at the best of their capacity, and it just doesn't happen to be that good. And there's endless data of really horrible science fiction that pile up in these bookstores. You can pretty much buy it by the yard. Try and find something good in it. So it's not a great harbinger of literature necessarily. But most of them are good reads. You know, most of them are keeping them in having enjoyed their stuff. I would say with the games, you have a possibility, and again, it depends on what you're allowed to do. Strategy guides for games are always in demand. I mean, those are always going to be good things. Depending if you have a team center and have resources available, one of the things that I've seen happening really quickly now is that people will have local area network partners. People who've done games, when the game Halo 3 came out, the weekend came out at a convention in Orlando, and a bunch of people just brought their game machines in. They created a network, they got a projector, they were projecting the game up on a big screen like this, so everybody could see a really little screen. Just a bunch of guys in the room, you know, fighting each other, just having great fun, just laughing, and having a really cool time. That's another way the resources are available to suggest and bring people in and get people together and give them an opportunity. You know, six kids play the game solo all by themselves, that's fun. They may have one friend who comes over and they can play side by side, but also they've got a place where they can bring their machines in and they can play in a group. That's an entirely different experience, and it's a very cool experience. One of the things that I will point out, because it's all online, because of other things, violence in video games has gotten, is often touted, and people shy away from it. The FBI, when they did a study of this Columbine shooting, and they analyzed what went on, their response to how to do violence in games was actually rather light. What they said in their report was that if people are engaged in violence as part of the game, further the game, get through the game, involve the game, that's not a problem. And they said, if people go through it with both of these games, you can hack it, there are codes you can use, so that you'll never die, and you'll have unlimited ammo, and the best weapons and stuff like that. Even if people go in and die on it, and run around and they're just killing things, that's actually not indicative of anything else either. That, in conjunction with other asocial behavior, might be a reason that you might want to take another look at this particular individual. So just being involved in these games has nothing to do with it. And it was just on a logical basis. If you think about it, Halo 3, its first weekend moved, I believe, over half a million units. Alright? And this is the game, the first you can game when you drop down and play, you're trying to keep it. If these sorts of games were able to cause people to commit violence, there would have been riots that particular weekend. There would have been people running around going, oh, we're not. In fact, no. What were they doing? They were sure faced with shooting each other. Alright? You know, no blow in the shed. So, you know, so for people who've got that sort of concern, you know, the anti guidance that share that sort of concern is certainly a lot. That ought to be a concern for individuals. While that may be a subject, you know, again, physics, we'll back you up on that a little bit. The other thing you've got is, if you do have games, you do have a lot of network games, like World of Warcraft, these are games where people are, everybody in their home playing the game, you're talking to people around the country. And again, Second Life is a game without a game. It's a software available for free. You get to wander around and people have built up, you know, just amazing land. It's very, very cool. These are not pieces of software you can probably offer through the library. But, in fact, money turned around and he, not World of Warcraft, but Second Life especially, could turn around and be a place where you could help that library. Just having a librarian who's got a presence there, by having a small space there to advertise, so people can come in, it's another way out of wildlife. So it's a relatively expensive place as well. Just to let people know that they can drop by and come see you in Second Life. Do it to NPR on Science Friday and NPR here. Whenever they're doing their show, they also have a Second Life presence. And so you'll have people who will telecommute to the Second Life presence to be able to ask questions that the host will then ask of the guest, and that will go out on the radio. Maybe you speak to someone while you're there.
Yeah. I didn't see why you did a number of them, but my boss actually came from Gordon down in Tucson and knows a librarian who, as part of her job, is required to spend 3 hours a day or X hours a week in Second Life as a librarian.
Sure. Yeah, no, all right. You did very good here. We were talking today, along with a Zoom partner. I've been playing around with publishing Facebook stories. There's a point I'm using Second Life to publish data as a book. And so we've got a short story publishing this book in 4 or 5 locations that we've set up and in other locations. There are actually reading rooms where these books are set up where people just come in and click on the book and they can read stuff while they're waiting for friends to come online and that sort of thing. And so suddenly they're getting exposed. You know, one of the reading rooms has got some speed books that they should love that. And there are other reading rooms that are using when they've got copyright material. And why do I need to create that exposure to my work? So I think that's really, really cool. But again, you can come in wherever. The other thing which is really good, if you were to have any possible stuff, if you have an opportunity in your library and to give a talk, it would be possible to either record that talk to apply that later, or to stream that talk either live or later into a place in Second Life. So you can have people who can actually be there, and then the people who can't to show up and maybe participate in the next project. And so that is another opportunity to sort of we give you for as a way to reach out and provide some community stuff. And then of course what you do, you know, once a year or once every, you know, once every 3 months or whatever, you just invite all of your Second Life people to show up, you know, show up at the conventional library. As well as, it could be scary, but, this is one of the things that, I've been doing with online communities since 1984. I want to put about a lot of communities here. But as well, you put a call out and say, hey, we're all going to get together at this place, at this time, and you meet up. And so you take somebody's first social network, and you provide a lot of your library, and you go and do your own thing. So that's pretty much the goal.
Second Life is free software.
It's free software. Download it from secondlife.com. and he worked on the, he worked on Mac, I think he worked on Linux, and he certainly worked on the PC. I know it was on Mac, that's what I got installed on. Definitely not Second Life, it costs you absolutely nothing, but you get no EA dollars. So you can run around and discover a lot of free stuff, which people do, use free stuff all over the place. But if you want to be fashionable and look good and travel, you want to buy these things, like throw it at a lot of you, shoot people and things. Then you have to and so it's not terribly expensive. And actually, one of the nice things about traveling around is that if you go to the time, depending on how long you've been in the game, will determine how much game money you can buy. So if you're a person wants to see, you can spend $10 American to get like $2,500 of game currency. So the game is really cool. But again, anybody can get an account. The other thing which is really cool about Second Life is that if you are under 18, all the domains, all the places you can go to Second Life have a rating. If you are under 18, you can't go to mature site. Your site is PC or D site. And vice versa, if you are over 18, you can't get into the senior kids site. It's a good tool, something but other questions?
Yeah, science fiction is not really covered too well, in our typical avenues of, finding new young adult literature, et cetera.
Sure.
Yeah. What sites or opportunities do we have to identify the leaks in the chat?
One of the things you can do, obviously, is pull pages. Two, you can go with, I had thought about what websites would be out there. Generally speaking, there are a lot of authors who are considered classic. Kuzbudu, Barnes & Noble, or a bookstore, I just start looking. But Asimov, Clark, a lot of guys who are with the editors, you can bring them in. There's also one of the things that you might consider is, you look at a book, a classic book like Newton, which is certainly very, very available, and Frank Herbert's son and Brian and Sherry Anderson are doing more books than that universe. So your universe has got a long track record of people can get into it, and there's new material that's going to be coming out. So I think if I were to go in, I'm going to look at other classic authors, and I would also look at seeing, especially if they have theories that go into that. So if you're going to, when you go out to share your authors, within that, because a lot of science fiction authors tend to grind a lot of stuff, cherry-pick the book that they've got four or five or six, at least four books in series. So Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit, for example, would be the bulk of the package that you would bring in. Because one of the things you're going to get is once somebody has started on that, they will need you all. So that would be the way.
Yeah, you could also search for the Hugo Award winners and the Nebula. And the Nebula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Grocery store. But in this case, not a grocery store, you're a group of grocery stores.
But I'm trying to think of young children who do that, comparing it to an adult. Is it the same thing between those two groups that draw them to something like that?
Who will chat because they're going to get them home, they can't afford to pay for babysitter, they have no place they want to go out. But this is the place they can go, it's not costing anything, they can watch the kids, and they can chat with friends. And they can see things, and they can do stuff. And so, for them, it's like, you know, and then, and where that gets bad is somebody who decides that, you know, some guy who says he's been to chat with their little supplier over London,
Star Wars X-Wing Rogue
Yeah, that was really good. But from my point of view, it follows the mirror. That was great. Actually, even better. Rogue Squadron, anybody who knew it understood it. And curious about this book, I didn't know this until after the fact. Because those were not even basic characters, Luke, being a fun, people in the town thought they were not going to use very well. They never thought they were going to use very well. And when that first book hit, everyone was surprised, or some were surprised. And then when the third book was coming out, the credit card was coming out, the week before it came out, from Stephen King through Fremont, the week before that came out, the paperback with the 15 New York Times bestseller, T.S. Todd. And everybody fans were saying, oh, no. Here's the Star Wars line. No, not related at all. So that was only movie, but not related at all. So those are just the movies that are Star Wars.
There are some librarians that have a larger science fiction collection than they have a literature collection.
Oh, cool.
And the Starless Universe that you write in, does what you write become canonized and when other people add on to other novels or in video games?
It literally depends on who the legacy or the legacy for it. In Star Wars works in a very specific hierarchy. The movies are canon, period. And then everything else is below that. And they really try to make sure that everything else respects and stays the continuity and maintain. And they're going to be great for what really, really hard at. Other licensees don't really care. Paramount with Star Trek doesn't really care. They will retread anything. It doesn't matter what happened over here. Everything's going to stay along with them. I have heard of some franchises that literally stuff that happens in the book, so literally to let that happen in the book and get reflected would be easier. So a character who died in the novel, then it's reported they die, later on in the TV series. So if the licensors are smart and they enjoy working with licensees, then they need to do really, really cool things. But not very good. Sometimes it's bad to be able to respond to the case. Sometimes it's just very weird. And that's why I did a case back when the Purple Prism was doing X-Files novels. I submitted along with 4 or 5 other authors. He submitted X-Files along. And all of them got out. I was the only person who wanted to see another one from. But all the instructions that they had was, all the feedback we got was, no, this is not X-Files. Great, guys. I really have to be here on camera. That's what we're doing in the future stuff. but that was just, they weren't doing X-Files. They were hot. They didn't have to explain it to anybody. It was just whatever they decided. And that was the way that worked. Other questions?
Yeah? When you're talking about some of the differences between games and books, and how it's true that so many video games don't really have character development or don't really have you know, they're not goals or anything.
Right.
But some of them are very story-oriented.
Sure.
Like, and you think you care about the characters, like the Final Fantasy series, for example, or some of the other ones. Can you mention your opinions on that?
Yeah, I think it's... The games where it is about story, where you have that fun story, are very effective. And again, you don't want to do them running around with that specific brand of those kinds of things. When you're actually writing those, and I've written for some of those, you really are writing scripts like you're writing movies, and then pretty much loading it for you. And so it is very systematic in that sense. And you just have to go through and get your voice and you can see those things in the crowd. But so you are reaffirming the story. Whereas, again, you know, something like Call of Duty, you know, first with the shooters, you're not worried about the story. So, yeah.
When you're writing for one of these games, like role-playing games,
mm-hmm.
How involved do you get in the development process, or are you just strictly the writer?
Again, it depends on the game. For a game called Wasteland, which came out in the late 80s, I knew a lot of developers. Didn't do any programming, but a lot of games and developers. For the game, all I've been doing is do scenarios and scripting. So again, it depends on what they want. Sometimes they will come to you to develop a project from the ground up. Other times, sometimes they'll say, hi, you're going to be doing the 4-pointer in theory. We already have the game engine. So all we need you to do is to tell us how we're going to be deploying this stuff. You know, write a little story, we'll figure out what the numbers are. So. Yeah.
The kids in my library were so thrilled when I said I was coming to see you. They want to know what you're doing next and when can they read?
Let's see. Right now what I'm doing is I turned in a proposal to my agent to be shopping over. So I've got an intro of fan show example. I started in October to try and have one back. So I've done that by the end of November. And John called me for it, but I've not even known him out. With a writing partner who lives here in Mesa, I've been doing screenplays. And the first thing you're going to get one big magazine creator's prize in their scriptwriting contest that you're going to have so that's me shopping around Hollywood, probably the registration, but the very first screenplay that I did that actually got produced, if you go to gamepass.com, they did a project the 10th anniversary of Tomb Raider. So they did a project that hired a bunch of writers to write new Laura Croft games. And so my writing partner is two of them. I did one of them. And one is the Cure of the Mothless. I think that's something of mine. But that's available for free from GameStop.com. This is a two-way revision project. But it's a little six and a half minute cartoon. But the Laura Croft is voiced by Jane Driver. So I can say my first release, no, sorry, Jane Driver. So I have no idea what this stuff is going to be coming out. Right now, it's just waiting to see. Anybody else? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.